Welcome, welcome, dear podcast listeners, to another edition of Between the Bubbles. We're right here. We have another Kickstarter project that we are promoting, written by Jesse Grillo, and it's a really fascinating novel called Chasing Gold Line Storms, which Jesse has just told me it's a work in progress title. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. It's a temp title. Yeah.
But, well, the story sounds really interesting. It's about someone who's schizophrenic, and which I'll go on a little bit later. It means a lot to me because I have some family members who suffer from mental diseases, and one of them specifically schizophrenia. So really interested to hear more about this project, what inspired it, what it's about. So, but anyway, before we start, let's get to know you, Jesse, as the writer and the novelist. And so tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
I live in Los Angeles, North Hollywood area. Been working in film for about 7 years, just kind of doing odd writing jobs. And during that time, as a hobby, I've kind of written other things. I've written a book of poetry. I've written a bunch of comic book scripts. And then on occasion, I was working with an artist to, you know, get the comic books made and whatnot. And the response was good. People seem to like my work. So just kind of been gearing towards making comic books this past year, and it's all been going really well. But I always try and like attack my writing from different angles. So back in January, I went on a 2-month road trip, and while I was on the road trip, I wrote a book. Been doing rewrites on that, and then about 10 days ago, I went back on the road and just to finish up the book and getting the final draft done. So yeah, so I like to write stuff.
Well, we actually reviewed in our first or second episode of Between the Bubbles your comic book, The Patriot, and there was something.
Yeah, I remember that. Thank you guys for doing that.
Oh,
yeah.
No problem. Yeah. I loved it. I backed the project. It was a really interesting take on a superhero, very much in my mind like Superman, who is very powerful, is the leader of the group, and he has a brain tumor, actually, if I'm correct. And is about to die.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it's one of those things, those ethical and moral dilemmas of, do I let the people who could control and destroy the world if I'm not around still live, or do I kill them because the world will be a lot safer place because I won't be there to guard it? And I thought it was a really interesting take on the whole superhero thing and idea. It was great. So I'm really looking forward to see how Chasing Gold Line Storms turns out, because I really like the Patriot.
It's a different kind of monster for sure, but yeah, it's a. I'm very proud of them both. I mean, they're just, you know, they've been big undertakings, but I've loved the whole process of making both of them.
Well, before we talk about Chasing Gold Line Storms, let's talk a little bit more about what got you into comic book writing. Since this is a comic book podcast, what got you into comic book writing initially?
My thing was, is I just tried to, as a screenwriter, I always tried to write in different genres and just kind of, just attack my weakest points. And, I was a pretty avid comic book reader anyways. And I had some stories that I thought were really cool visually. I kind of consider myself a very visual writer. And, I don't know, I think like storytelling is just, if you're a storyteller, that part, I don't know, that's the part that you love. It's kind of the medium that you want to bring your story across, and it, you know, what works best for this idea, or, you know, would this work good for a screenplay? So I had like this kind of like high concept sci-fi action comic booky idea, I guess. And I was like, well, this works a lot better than a comic. So not really understanding a whole lot about how to make comic books, I just worked with a storyboard artist on a show that I was working on. And we made this comic, and it looked terrible.
And then, that's a first endeavor. Yeah, you know what happens.
Oh yeah, no, I that thing. If there's any copies, like they're buried somewhere deep. And then I worked on a second one with a guy, and the first two were definite learning experiences. Like the second guy wasn't reliable. And then I got really lucky, and I worked with David Brame, who's done four comic books with me now. Just amazing artist, reliable, and we just clicked so well, because he's all about making comic books, and you know, it was great. I think when we first started talking, we were talking about, like, you know, how much it would cost to get this all done. And, you know, he's giving me his rate and everything. I was like, well, yeah, that's great. But I have a lot of stories, so I don't really know if I can afford, you know, all that much. And then once he read the script for the first comic he worked on, which was Chapel, he really liked it. So he decided to move forward, and we've had this really great working relationship since then. Yeah.
That's cool, because I've noticed with other Kickstarters that I've seen on Twitter and other people post on Facebook, and I think you actually posted this question as well, is what do you do when your artist is really flaky and they're not meeting the timeline and the deadline that you have set, and they're really difficult to struggle with? I mean, what do you do? Do you abandon the whole project, or do you keep going and just wait, finish it out? I mean, it's kind of a tough one.
Well, you know, that, it's a tough one. You know, I'm actually not naming names, but I'm actually kind of going through that right now with one of the artists. And it's tough, man, because it's just like, you know, every artist has been taken advantage of, you know, every comic book artist has been taken advantage of at some point. You know, it's just like they don't get paid. They have to deal with the same nonsense that we do. But it's like, not, and I'm not saying I'm anyone, but when you really go out of your way to make sure that, like, you know, that they're paid a fair rate, they're paid on time, they're, you know, and you try and be, you know, as a, you know, you try and give them as good of a setup as you possibly can, and you're fair with that. It's tough when you know when artists are just flaky or they walk away. You know, I got into this thing the other day where I was talking online. People are like, well, you have to have a contract. Like, you should get a contract with an artist, and that's it. It while that's good, it doesn't really mean a whole lot if the artist is like out of state. You know, you have to like go to that person's state in order to like, you know, sue them. Yeah, you know, it's an expensive process.
It's not even worth it.
Well, ultimately, it's not worth it. And especially, it's like, you know, if you're talking about like what, $500, $1,000, like, are you really going to go through all that? You know, the best thing you can do is
you're going to lose all that money in legal fees anyway.
Yep, exactly. Well, yeah, welcome to my world. But, yeah, it's a
tough
one,
man.
So it's like, yeah, the only thing you can really do is you have to just protect yourself as much as possible, and, you know, check referrals. Check the person's work. Generally, what I do with a setup is I'm very lenient with them. Like, if you can just turn in at least like 2 pages a week, you know, if it's less than that, it's fine. But let's work it out. As soon as you turn in a page, I'll pay you that same day, you know, for the agreed upon rate. You know, as long as your work's up to par, like, you know, it's a pretty good setup. And you just be surprised, like, people are, you know, they just kind of drift off, or they get, you know, get other gigs, I guess, or what their deal is. I mean, so I honestly don't really understand it, because there's just so many artists out there that would love to work and, you know, make a comp and actually like make a little bit of money at it. You know, it's not a lot, but it's, you know, it's something.
Yeah, and they're not taking advantage of the situation.
I,
and in this case, for the guy that you're
like,
working with.
Yeah.
Wow, that's tough.
I'm sorry. I heard half of that. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, I was saying, you know, there's the guy that you're working with, and he's not taking advantage of the situation that you presented him.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a bit mind-boggling to me, too, you know. But, I don't know. I guess this is creative people and that odd wiring that they have. But, I mean, you know, and honestly, I'm not saying I'm anyone special, but I've always been, like, I've always had a really good working relationship with like every artist I've worked with. Like, you'd ask, you know, at this point it's like almost 20 artists between the letterers and the colorists and the pencilers and inkers. And, you know, I really go out of my way to try and make things work, you know, promote their work, try and get them gigs, you know, make sure that they're paid. You know, I'm not Marvel or DC. I'm not given $150 a page, but, you know, it's like, yeah, I'll pay like $75 a page, $100 a page for pencils and inking. You know,
that's out of your pocket.
Oh yeah, it's out of my pocket. Oh yeah, yeah. The crowdfunding. You know, I do the crowdfunding thing with the Kickstarters and all that. But I mean, that's a very small dent of it. You know, it's just to kind of helps take some of the sting out of it. The tough part is you know, I haven't really worked since about December, and a lot of these projects like Patriot I had going back in December, but then I became unemployed, so I wasn't able to continue with it. Luckily, you know, crowdfunding's helped out a lot with that, but I've been working odd jobs and whatnot. That's not like I'm selling thousands of dollars worth of comics. Yeah, it's tough, but I mean, you know, the thing is if you believe in your work and you know, if it's like, honestly, I can't think of my, you know, doing anything else now. It's wow. Like I have no desire to go back to film. I have no desire to, you know, go out and work some other gig that I've worked in the past. I'm like, I just love writing as much as I can and creating comics. I'm like, that's the most satisfying thing ever. And I'm perfectly fine being poor and doing that. Yeah, hey, if I'm able to break even, that'd be nice.
Yeah, like, hey, you got to do what you got to do. And the interesting thing is you just gave us a great insight into the struggles and the world of independent comic book making. I mean, the feelings of success, right. But also the feelings of frustration. It's really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Well, I mean, it's cool I think, I mean, it's really tough at the beginning, you know, when you're working with other people that, you know, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. It's like, oh yeah, I'll just get a storyboard artist. I don't need an inker. I don't need this. But as with, I think, almost anything, as it progresses, it gets easier. You find other people that are as passionate about what you want to do, and it grows from there. But, no, it can definitely be frustrating at times.
Well, that's cool. Hey, well, then now let's talk about your book, then, Chasing Gold Line Storms. The thing that I'm most interested, because as I've said, it talks about a person who is, did they just develop schizophrenia, or have they had it for a while?
Yeah, well, generally this character, he's a child of someone with a mental illness, and his mother was bipolar, and there's this kind of a rule or guideline when you're a child of someone with mental illness is you're usually diagnosed in your teens or early 20s. And if you make it to 30 years old, it's seen as like the finish line, like you're safe if you make it to 30. And this guy has always had that fear that he was going to develop some kind of mental illness. And he's turned 30, and he starts to show the signs of schizophrenia when he's 30, which is pretty rare, but it does happen.
It's tragic because and even he was that close to the safe point.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like the they caught up with them, though. But yeah, what he had was a schizophrenic break, which is an interesting thing when you read up on it, because it's some people can go through their whole lives and they'll have one schizophrenic break and then they'll never like show signs of schizophrenia again, or sometimes they'll have a break and then show signs of schizophrenia. But generally what happens is you usually have schizophrenia at a very young age, and it's hard to diagnose children because usually they attribute it to overactive imagination. And then
so they get it, you know, like they're kids.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, they usually diagnose it in, you know, teenagers and early 20s. So 30 is a pretty late age to develop it. So, but yeah, and I thought that was a really interesting idea. You know, the whole like, you know, you think you're safe from this illness, and then it catches up to you. You know, and how do you react to that? Being a 30-year-old, you know, you're setting your career, you're setting your ways, now you have this, you know, debilitating illness.
Yeah, well, your whole life changes.
Yeah, and it was just kind of, I just kind of asked myself. I mean, you know, it was kind of similar to Patriot. I just asked myself. It's like, well, what would I do? Like, if I was hit with that, like, what if I was a superpower with godlike powers? Like, how would I really react? Like, would my ego take over? Would I do this? How would I react if I, you know, found out that very soon, you know, I was going to have to go on serious medication for the rest of my life. I was going to have to, you know, change everything about myself. It's like, but what, you know, there's that saying that you write what you know. And so there's so much of myself in this. I mean, I'm also, well, I'm 31 now, but I was also, you know, a 30-year-old writer, and I was kind of, you know, a little bit over the film business. And this guy's very similar. And, you know, so I just kind of put myself in his shoes, and I was like, if I was this guy and I found out I had this condition that might take away the personality that I have, what would I do? And ultimately what this character does is he figures out that he doesn't even really know who he is now, and that's going to be taken away from him. So he goes on the road to kind of find himself before he loses himself to the condition.
Now, our listeners don't know this, but you are actually yourself doing a road trip, starting in Central California, or did you start in L.A.?
I started in Los Angeles, yeah.
Started in Los Angeles, and now you're up in Eugene, Oregon, is that correct?
Mm-hmm, yeah, sure is.
So, are you doing the road trip then to get a better sense of, and the character, the main character is Joshua Blackwood, and are you doing this road trip to get a better sense of what it would be like for him to do this road trip to kind of deal with the situation?
Yeah, you know, it's I'm researching the character, but it's also the character is experiencing many of the same things that I have, but I'm building on my stories and then making it part of his world, where there's people that I've met, and my experiences, and I build on that and make it his thing, and what would it be like to see the same world but through the eyes of someone that's losing their mind, you know, someone that's really terrified. But what I did was also kind of cool was as the road trip progressed, I interviewed people while I was on the road, and this character, he kind of starts off as like a Hollywood douchebag kind of guy, like,
yeah.
You know,
they usually
like rhinestone
are.
Shirts or whatever. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. That's why I want to move.
And but, you would probably know, since you've worked in Hollywood, that it's probably not too far from stereotype.
Yeah, that's pretty. It's pretty spot on. But I mean, I don't know. There are. I mean, I'm not talking crap about the whole town, but I mean, yeah, there's definitely some characters down there. But you know, as the character progresses, like he. You know, he learns a lot about other people and kind of his own perspective on things, and it changes drastically, you know. So one thing that I did was I was interviewing people, and it was basically all that I was doing was asking one question, and it's like, well, tell me a secret about yourself that only you know or only a few people know about you. And you wouldn't believe some of the responses I got, like just because they didn't know me and I told them, you know, I wouldn't use their real name or anything like that. And it gave really interesting insight into people, and I did over 20 interviews, and you know, it kind of taught me and it taught the character that, you know, the human experience is pretty universal, you know, that we all have these fears, and we all have, you know, these oddities about us, and it's kind of how you deal with that makes you it makes you survive and makes you learn from it.
And how did you contact these people? Or how did you find
them? You know, it's just random people I met. Yeah, you know what I was doing, I didn't plan anything. I just got on the road and started driving. I had
really,
you know, just yeah. I had Christmas dinner with my family, and then yeah. No, but I mean, it's great. But yeah, you never really know what could happen. But the plan was I had a Christmas dinner with my family. Next day, I got in my car and started driving north, and that was it. Like no time frame, no destinations or anything like that. I mean, I was just gonna go north until something led me somewhere else. And I didn't know for how long or anything like that. So that was back in December. I did that for 2 months, and then I handwrote the first draft. Went back to LA, did a bunch of rewrites. Just kind of worked on it, and it's right where I want it to be. But you know, I kind of want to go. The love interest happens in Portland, so I really wanted to spend a little more time in Portland and kind of get into that mindset, and then also go back on the road and kind of go to the same places and just tighten everything up. But yeah, it's been great. But yeah, the same trip, I'm doing the same thing. We're right back in the character's kind of mindset. And
wow. Now, how long have you been working on this project then?
Since December. I mean, yeah.
So it wasn't before, it wasn't after, like that Christmas dinner. The day after you decide, look, I'm going to just focus on this book and have at it. That is crazy.
I didn't even really have a set. It's been amazing. It's been an amazing experience. You know, I've been doing the comic book thing too, a little bit on the side.
That's what I'm amazed about, because you're doing, trying to get funding for Patriot, and now you're doing Kickstarter for this, and you also.
I've done like four Kickstarters too. Yeah. So I've done that.
And you also have your website, your comic book production company, Bleeding Ink Productions.
Right.
How do you find time for all of this?
Well, it's all I do. I went to the Eugene Public Library, and I did some comic book updates on the Facebook. There's some new art that came in. I put it on the Facebook, responded to some emails. Sent an email to my website guy. We're still getting, the website's looking good, but it's still, you know, in the works. And then, it's tough. I mean, it's, the other thing, I mean, the huge part of it, besides all that, is the marketing. Like that's the nutty part. Like, the Facebook for the Bleeding Ink, it, I really only started that back in when I came back from my road trip, because it like I kind of my own revelation while I was on the road is like, well, all you do is write and it's what you love, so you should probably take it a little more seriously and promote yourself and get your work out there and, you know, make it a thing, because, you know, it's like, why not? So when I came back in February, I didn't have any like followers on my Facebook. Like, I didn't have really any much of a fan base. Like, no one knew who Blaine Inc. Comics was. And yeah, today I have like over 2,300 followers that follow me on Facebook. And then like combined on Twitter, I have like 17,000 followers.
17,000?
Yeah, well, I have one that's like Jesse Grillo, which is like my poetry and my writing, you know, the updates about the book and stuff. And then I have one for Bleeding Ink Productions, which is like another 9,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm shaking. Yeah,
no,
it's right
humbling
now,
and
can,
weird.
I can't. Wow. Because so Bray and I started Between the Bubbles about 2 months ago, and we're both grad students, and we think we're busy doing the grad student thing with the whole podcast. And then I hear what you're doing, and. Wow.
Well, grad school is pretty tough, man. I wouldn't be too hard on yourself.
I just can't believe how you're juggling all this. That is admirable. Holy cow. Wow.
Yeah.
That is
crazy. Well, it's definitely a bit overwhelming at times, but you know, I mean, the making comics part is great, honestly. If you took out the marketing and the website stuff and all that jazz, like I'd be fine, you know. I love writing. I love making comics. It's not that's like the easy part. That's my you know, it's
that's
the part I look
outlet.
Forward to.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, but like the marketing and oh man, it can be a bit much.
No,
but,
I feel
yeah,
you on that
it's
one.
It's all worth it.
I feel you on that one.
Yeah.
So, what inspired this book? That's what I'm most intrigued about. What inspired Chasing Gold Line Storms?
There's a lot. You know, it's the same with the character. He's kind of he's a screenwriter as well and works in film, and he's a little bit over the film business. I was very over the film business back in December. I just got done with the gig and just kind of, you know, done with Hollywood and all that jazz. I never really fit in anyways. So I think it spawned from that and kind of grew. You know, this character, he's very kind of over the top, where he's, you know, the douchebag guy is a bit of a womanizer, and then he finds out he has this condition, so he's going to lose himself to this condition, but he doesn't even like the person that he already is. So it was that. My mother actually was she was bipolar, so I know a lot came from that, and then just the concept of, you know, being 30 years old and finding out. But yeah, I don't know. I thought it was a great like character arc for the character, and I don't know. It just kept running. And then the other thing is that I didn't really plan it at all before I went on the road. I think I had like a very rough idea, but I didn't have anything written down. And I got in my car. I think I had four pairs of sets of clothes for changing, and then I had like three or four notebooks. I didn't even bring a laptop with me the first trip. And I just went, and that was it. Like, I didn't bring anything with me, and just got on the road and went. I didn't want any distractions, anything to take me away from the character. So it kind of developed from there. And yeah, wow. I went up to and 2 months on the road on that one. I don't think this trip will be that as long. Probably do like a month maybe.
That's still crazy that you just went and drove and just doing the whole road trip, no plans. That's great. The thing I find the most interesting in your book is every single person, I don't care who you are, always has that deep down fear. What would happen if I lose my mind? You know, with Alzheimer's, dementia, you don't remember who you are, you don't remember your loved ones. And I think something like this, especially with someone who is young, who is in the prime of their life, and then having a schizophrenic break, as you said, I think that's something that readers can relate to. Not that we'll have one ourselves, but once again, it always plays into that deep fear, because we always want to have our own identity. And
that's the thing that intrigues me the most. I mean, the thing was, too, is I mean, not saying that I'm trying to, you know, do something really positive with the book, but I mean, definitely, like, I definitely tried to break a lot of the stigmas that come up with mental illness. I mean, you know, it's not like I gave this guy an imaginary character to talk to. Like, I interviewed a psychiatrist about it, and actually two schizophrenic people. And I've read like several books on schizophrenia, so I know a pretty good amount about it now. But it's just like, I don't know, you just see so many shows and you read so many books.
Beautiful Mind, that's not schizophrenia, where he sees all the different characters.
No, they completely made everything up. Well, what's really interesting about that movie is, you know, that he never had visual schizophrenia. He had audio schizophrenia. So he heard things, but in his life, that person, he never saw anything. He never saw a visual hallucination.
That's what's my cousin. My cousin will hear things, but he doesn't have imaginary friends. He doesn't have people tell him what to do. He hears things, and it's such a trigger that says, for him, it's a sign from God or a message from God that he should act a certain way or do a certain thing. And saw Beautiful Mind, I was really annoyed because I thought, you're not even getting an accurate portrayal at all of schizophrenia.
Right. And it, you know, that won Academy Award, didn't it? Like,
exactly.
True life story.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's insane. But I think it's also, that's an extreme example. But I mean, you see it all over the place. You see it in Fight Club. You see these TV shows. It's like, oh, he has a superpower. He's able to memorize things. He has this mental disorder. He has this. And it's like, wow, like our perceptions of mental illness are just completely wrong. And in every regard, pretty much, you know, it's like even schizophrenia, it's 1 in 100 Americans have schizophrenia. Like, odds are, you know someone or one of your friends is affected by someone with schizophrenia. Like, it's incredibly common. And those are ones that are diagnosed. You
exactly.
know, it doesn't even include other forms of mental illness. Yeah, so,
well, and bipolar, will say with bipolar that it's blown out of proportion, or not to say it's just it's in their head, because obviously there is something going on with them mentally, but that it's more that they're overreacting to situations and they can fix it by just controlling themselves. And no, there's a real chemical imbalance going on there. A real thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would say whoever says that probably hasn't lived with a bipolar person.
No, they haven't.
Different. Yeah, I mean, there are people with mild bipolar disorders, but you know, it's a lot different than being moody, definitely. You know?
Exactly.
But I just tried to kind of break a lot of the stigmas, and I mean, the character does the same thing. But I volunteered at a homeless shelter in Oakland while I was there for 2 days, and you wouldn't believe how much mental illness was there. And there's just like no answer. There's no help for these people. It's the saddest thing. You know, you have this incredibly expensive medication that that on average a schizophrenic person, that the medication, because they're just so heavy antipsychotics, it just completely destroys their livers, kidneys, and they're expected to live about 25 years less than an average person.
Oh man.
You know, so you have that looking. So you're looking at that. You're looking at really expensive medication that no one can afford. If you don't have health insurance, you're not getting it. Like, I'm sorry, you know, unless you're a millionaire. And there's no solution there. Like, there's no help for these people. So they're just kind of put it on the street. It's like, okay, well, now you're seeing things or you're hearing things or whatever, and now you're, you know, on the street, and there's no answer. It's the saddest thing.
You know? And there's nothing you can do. In fact,
I
was in a public health class, and we talked about the homeless, and it was a crazy statistic, but large majority of people who are homeless are the mentally ill. And so we say, oh, the homeless, you know, they just get a job and go out and work. We don't need to take care of them. It's like, okay, you know what? Like you were saying, they can't take care of themselves unless they have that heavy medication that will, you know, destroy their liver.
Right.
It's super, super expensive. And no, there's a huge problem, and they need help.
Well, I think there's also another one of our stigmas in our society is homeless people. Like, I've never met a homeless person that was just, like, lazy, you know? It's like, oh, well, yeah, why would I work? I can just hang out, you know? It's not that's not how it works, you know? It's basically two things that I saw when I was doing that. And I actually pretended I was homeless on my last road trip for 2 days when I was in Eugene, actually. I'm not doing it this time, but you know, I interacted with a lot of homeless people, and it's basically two things. It's a, you know, severe mental illness or even mild mental illness, and then drug addiction. And besides that, I really didn't see a whole lot else. You know, I saw a little bit of women that came from, like, you know, battered husbands or abusive families, but it's a tough one. Yeah.
Wow. Well, it, the cool thing is that it sounds like you've really put yourself into this project more than just writing it, but trying to really understand the whole world of mental illness, living it, experiencing it through people who have mental illness, and you've really dedicated yourself for this novel.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm very method about it. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've been keeping a blog for this trip on our website, and even though it's not comic book related, but you know, whatever, people can deal. So it's so funny because I'll post like a new piece of art and it's like, oh, you have 120 new likes or whatever, and I'm like, hey, I'm writing a novel and I'm doing this method thing, it's weird, and it's like 2 likes in there or something. But yeah, but it's
we're,
fine.
We're picky
it.
People as comic book readers, we're picky.
No, I mean, yeah, I totally get it, but it's like, I don't even bother, you know, promoting my poetry too much on there. It's like, you know, that just yeah, you hear crickets, you know. But
that's funny.
Yeah, so I've been given like these updates throughout the trip, and I've kind of been doing it in character a lot of it. And yeah, it's interesting. When I first left on this trip, I got like this Hollywood douchebag shirt, and it was like really tight fitting, and I kind of tucked it in my belt buckle, and I had like these, you know, designer sunglasses on. I took like a picture of myself in the mirror, and I'm like clean shaven.
Actually, I saw that picture on Facebook.
How did you? Yeah, that was for the book. I don't really look like that.
Okay. Well, I figured since you've, you know, labeled it with the label that you had, I figured that it wasn't you. But it was
funny. That'll get out somewhere. Yeah, someone will get that picture and they'll like remove the label and say, "Oh, this is Jesse. It's nice." But
I promise it's not me.
Yeah. But I just took a picture of myself today. I have this pretty shaggy beard and my hair is destroyed. And I've actually lost 11 pounds since I started the trip too,
wow,
which is kind of weird. Yeah, I don't know what that means, but I've been eating okay, but just kind of a lot of weight. But yeah, it's the weird. I mean, it's great for writing. The writing comes so easy when you're in that kind of same mindset as your character, when you really understand your characters. But it's odd. Yeah, I didn't sleep last night either. Like it's a strange, wonderful place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's ask you.
But if I ever do it again, I'm definitely gonna pick another character that has a better life. It's much easier. He's like, yeah.
A billionaire, playboy. That's what you do next time.
Yeah, I just, you know, he drives his hovercraft around. You know, just
yeah, kinda, basically. Yeah. No, see how that works. Out, yeah. Okay, so one last question. What? And I think this is the most important one for your project. What makes Chasing Goldline Storms special and different, and why should people get behind it?
I think the main thing that kind of separates it out from any book that's you've ever read, or I mean, I don't know, maybe there are books like it, but as the book progresses, the writing style changes because of his break. It's a very quick transition to schizophrenia over a period of like 3 months, and so the first about like 40 pages, he's very, very clean, very, very good grammar and whatnot. And then very slowly you start to see these grammatical errors and then more grammatical errors. And then, he'll be writing a sentence and then it might like start turning into a spiral. And then he starts to like include pictures and little drawings. And then as he gets really into his sickness, the book becomes this kind of very artistic, very disturbing yet beautiful, you know, thing of where it's like a ripped out piece of a menu, or he when he has this love affair, this girl gives him, it's Valentine's Day and they don't really know each other, but they pretend that they go out on a Valentine's date, and they're like overly romantic to each other first in like a playful way, kind of like joking with it, and then it kind of develops into something. But she gives him like a donut, and it has these like three heart-shaped candies on it, and you know, that's in the book. He has like a little picture of that in the book, and he has, you know, it's a very personal, you know, thing of this person that doesn't exist, but it's a lot of me, and it's a lot of kind of the people that I've interacted with, but it's been built in and kind of developed into the story, and it's definitely interesting. You know, maybe it ends up I'm just a terrible writer or whatever, but just that alone, I think it's really brings a lot of qualities to the book. And I put chapters online too for people to read, and the response has been amazing. So I really think it's going to turn out well. And honestly, if not a lot of people buy it or anything, it's not a big deal, because it's been such a labor of love, and it's something I'm definitely very, very proud of.
Well, and it sounds like in this whole interview that you've really put your heart and soul and dedication into it, and it's really fascinating. All right. To all the different things that you've done, you know, traveling, reading the books, having the interviews, pretending to be homeless. Mm-hmm. That's really, really cool. And I know that I personally will be backing Chasing Gold Line Storms. And wow, it was an interesting interview. I mean, listeners, you learned about the inner workings of independent comic books and the struggles and successes that happened there. You learned about mental illnesses and the reality of living with someone with a mental illness. And now you learned about a great, great book called Chasing Gold Line Storms by Jesse Grillo. So, wow, yeah, that was a packed full interview there.
Over the place.
Yeah,
But yeah, I mean, yeah, and yeah, you know, my thing is like people, you know, don't look at the Kickstarter as a, you know, charity case or anything like that. I don't want that. I want people to read my work and, you know, just kind of, you know, buy it because you think it might be a good book. It's definitely, you know, it's worth that, definitely.
Yeah,
it's
not, it sounds not like
a, not
it
a thing. Like, yeah. Yeah. So.
Hey, well, thank you, Jesse. And we will be posting the Kickstarter project, the link. We'll be posting his website, Bleeding Ink. Is it bleedinginkcomics.com?
No, you know, we had comics at the beginning on the Facebook, but you know, I'm doing the book and the poetry and other stuff, so it's kind of with productions. So yeah, we got bleedingproductions.com, and then we're on Twitter and Facebook and all that jazz. But yeah, and the website's coming along. It'll be good in a couple of weeks. It'll be all set up. But yeah, there's a store on there. You can get some of our comics and yeah. Yeah, you know, and definitely check out the blog. That's got some interesting stuff on it.
Well, there you go. We'll be putting all those links there. So,
right, yeah.
Hey,
there goes you, and I'll throw mine.
Well, thank you so much, Jesse, and good luck on the project, and we hope you meet your goal. And to all you podcast listeners out there, it's been another great Kickstarter interview here between the bubbles, and happy reading.
All right, and welcome to another Kickstarter special edition of Between the Bubbles. Today we're going to be interviewing Jose, who has a very cool Kickstarter that we're really excited about, and we really want to help him support. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Jose. Where are you originally from?
I like that you throw the Jose in there, because I was born in Panama.
In Panama, very nice.
Yes.
Oh, well, see, I am a Spanish PhD candidate, so I can do a good Jose Torres. You know, I can do it the way it needs to be done.
Oh, man, you roll your R's. Like, growing up, because I left Panama when I was about 4 years old, but I can't roll my R's. I've never been able to, and it was always, like, the big joke.
It takes a long time to learn it.
Yeah, but, like, as a baby born there, you'd think it's just, like, in your genes, but no, never happened.
You would hope. And,
like, the only person in my extended family, like, little brothers, baby brothers, everyone can do it, just not me.
Yeah, it's funny. I used to live in Spain, and when I lived in Spain, there were kids who just couldn't do it. And I was like, you are Spanish. You have lived here your whole life. Come on. But then I realized it's a genetic thing as much as it is a talent that you have to learn. If your tongue literally can't do it, there's nothing you can do about it.
It's like Americans that can't play baseball or something.
Exactly. You know, this is, or bacon apple pie, you know.
Yeah.
You would think that should be in the American DNA, but no. So you're from Panama originally. Where are you living these days, Jose?
Right now I live in it's called Nantyglo, Pennsylvania. It's pretty much, I live on a mountain in Pennsylvania. It's
that
nice.
That is cool. I'm jealous. I'm living in Iowa these days, and the rolling hills of corn are nice, but sometimes I would like a nice mountain.
Oh, it's nice. There's beautiful views, and it's like a... Now that I'm out of the military, it's a good place to decompress. Like, I do a lot of mountain running and a lot of, like, I try and stay very physically active, and it's a good place to do that, because you're not just kind of, like, running on a lot of flat and seeing a lot of boring stuff. You can actually, like, I'm trying to train up to do, like, mud runs and things like that.
Very cool.
And very good terrain for that sort of stuff.
So you were in the military. Which branch?
I was in the Army.
Very, very
just
cool.
A regular, yeah, I was in the active army. I was a combat documentation and production specialist, which is just fancy for photographer and videographer who really? Also knows how to edit everything. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. That's not a thing that you hear a lot of people doing, but obviously it's something they need. So it's good that someone was doing it.
Yeah, it was a good time. It was just sort of one of those. I did really well on the aptitude test, and so they just kind of gave me this giant list of things to do, and I just kind of I got to pick and choose and see what looked like the coolest job, and yeah, it was pretty cool because you get to be there on the front lines, and I mean you do your fair share of like frontline stuff, but really your main job is to take pictures and record everything. So
yeah,
after everything's done, you actually get a chance to like absorb it and review it as you edit everything.
That's pretty cool and a really important thing, like something you just don't think about in combat, but you've got to be there to document all that stuff so that, you know, after action reports can be filed and, you know, other what do you call them? Well, yeah. Strategies can be devised, all that kind of stuff.
Well, part of it too with us is like the forensic aspect, because
that's true.
With special operations, you're not just really doing patrols. It's like targeted missions. You're going places to get people, and when you get them, you need evidence. You know, it's like any other police action where someone, if you're going to lock someone up, you don't just throw that guy in jail and forget about him.
You got to have that evidence. Yeah, that's a good point. Very cool. So, how long were you in the military?
I was in for a little over 3 years.
Cool.
Yeah.
So now you're out, you're living in Pennsylvania. What got you into comics?
I'd actually been doing comics before I joined the military.
Very cool.
I'd always grown up reading them, and I lucked into a publishing deal with Image pretty much right out of high school. A buddy of mine and I, we spent all high school putting this book together, and we literally mailed it in a manila envelope, and it was what they were looking for at the time.
And that's pretty cool. So Image has published your stuff previously.
Yes.
That's cool. What was the name of the book?
It was called Heirs of Eternity. And I also did a horror book for the now defunct Speakeasy Comics, but Marcosia put out the graphic novel. It was with the artist Chris Dabari. He's done stuff for Top Cow. He's done stuff for Boom then. And yeah, we did that horror book as well.
So you had a stint in comics, you left to be in the military, and you came back and got back into it, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it was one of those things that, like, when you're over there, part of how my mind has always sort of processed things is just, like, the writing it down, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was over there, just so much stuff was happening, because we were there. I mean, I don't know if you remember, like, last summer they caught Osama bin Laden, troops almost didn't get paid, all sorts of stuff, and you're there in the kind of like the eye of the storm.
Yeah.
And I'd taken Descartes' Meditations with me, and I was sort of just reading like the whole, like the, where he talks about the wax and when it melts and the properties of the wax and what about the wax is still there after you burn it down so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And just like mission after mission, that's how I felt. I was just like, it gets to the point where you're just like, you kind of don't know who you are because you were this one person. Like I went into the military later on in life. Like I turned 30 in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived my 30 years. I get over there and all of a sudden it's just like death and destruction every day.
Hmm.
And you really like between that and reading that book, I was just like, I just started taking things down and really thinking about it.
Yeah. I think you get to a point where you just have to reevaluate your choices and figure out, is this, you know, is this the person I want to be?
Yeah. Oh, most definitely. And also just, like, in a heavy combat situation, all you have really is your training and what you're doing. You know, you have your job and you do it, and that's how you get by. You never get scared. You never, like, I never actually had any kind of physical reaction to what was happening until after the missions were over.
Yeah.
While I was there, I was just working. And looking back on that, you're just kind of like, Who was doing all that work and not really caring, and it's you, like, to and you have to find what part of yourself it is that can do that.
Wow. So I guess it takes a certain kind of disconnect to be able to do that.
Most definitely, and I think that the camera really facilitates that, because you are, to some extent, since you're seeing it all through the camera, there is kind of like a barrier between you and what's happening some of the time.
Hmm. That's really fascinating. I never really thought about that. Like, again, like I said, it's one of those things that you know intellectually is a thing that the military uses, but I've never spoken to anyone who does it before. So it's really, it's an interesting paradigm of military life, I guess.
It's, yeah, it was, I mean, it you read the Kickstarter page. It's sort of, we taught, like, I used the whole tilt shift metaphor of everything through a lens, because it did, for me, it really made all the difference, because, I mean, coming back and having to edit, like, pictures of dead people and things like that, you're sitting there and you're color correcting, like, gore.
Yeah.
And it really, like, it sinks in, but it also helps with the processing of everything.
Yeah, that would make sense. I guess it gives you an outlet to process that carnage that you've seen, I guess.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, let's talk a little bit about your project. It's named Tilt Shift. And what exactly is it about?
It's pretty much, it covers the six-month deployment of a young combat photographer working with a special operations team that's specializing in kill capture and known area of interest missions. And, it's just pretty much, it's fictionalized because a lot of what we do, like, you can't really talk about it.
Yeah.
And so within the bounds of what we can talk about, and with the sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, this is all fiction. I'm trying to give the most complete picture of what happens over there to people just through my firsthand knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So it's definitely, while it's not, you know, like you say, it's not necessarily true stories of what happened to these exact people, it's clearly influenced and inspired by your own experiences over there.
Yes.
Very cool. So how long have you been working on this project?
I first got the idea to start trying to do something like that. Like, as I was training up to go down there, we did some pretty... the Army actually spent some pretty solid money to put some very realistic training together for us.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were doing the training, like, I'd been friends with Josh for probably about 10 years at this point. And so when I started doing it, this training... Just in talking to him, I just sort of started shooting ideas at him, and he started actually doing some of the initial kind of rough sketches. And then once I got over there and everything was real, I put the project together, and he was definitely on board. He'd actually stepped away from comics himself for a while to do more magazine design art and illustration, and just talking about what was going on and talking about these ideas I had for the book, we ended up just sort of putting the book together.
Very cool. So tell us a little bit more about Josh. He's obviously your artist.
Yes.
Give us some background on him.
I mean, Josh is, he's been pretty much exclusive Marvel and DC the whole time he was in comics. I think he originally came into the, got brought into the kind of like the house of Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
and was doing, he did like the Green Goblin and books like that for Marvel. And then he, hopped over from Marvel to DC, where he worked on books like Superboy and the Ravers and some other things. I mean, it was like late 90s, early 2000s, mm-hmm. sort of Marvel DC. And I think it kind of culminated and he did, JLA Scary Monsters, with Chris Claremont, and he was the artist on Aquaman for a bit.
Very cool.
And then after that, he stepped away from that for a while to concentrate more on illustration and design and do magazine work. And but, yeah, he's super talented, and he's one of those guys, like, I think he's very, like, he has a lot of, like, art education.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came to him, like, when we were talking about the project... Because, like, I mean, military people are very, like, detail-oriented.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I was a photographer, so I have, like, just a giant, like, a wealth of photo reference for him. He's been really good about using the photo reference and giving it the hyper-realistic feel that we're trying to convey.
Yeah, from the sample artwork that's up on the Kickstarter, I definitely get that that gritty, realistic feel to it. This is not, you know, this is not your kiddie war book. This is something that has some real gravitas, I feel like, to it.
That's definitely what we're going for. I think back to kind of like with the recent passing of Joe Kubert, as well as Will Eisner's things, like that kind of World War II Korea, and even some of the Vietnam stuff, where a lot of it was written and illustrated by people who had actually served in the military.
Yeah,
and so they were able to put the posture, the gestures, the lines in the face, the wear and tear in the uniforms, things like that. We're definitely trying to channel that and give it that sort of life that those people were able to put into their work for the wars that they covered and that they portrayed in graphic novel and comic book form.
Definitely. So you're doing the writing, Josh is doing the art. Are you guys working with anyone else, or is it just the two of you?
We have Michael Babinski is doing the inking, and Mike Spicer is doing the colors. Mm-hmm. Both of them, they've both done a lot of work for Marvel, and I know Mike Spicer has done stuff for Top Cow and for other companies like that. I'm sort of blanking on their on their kind of
their resumes.
Yeah, on the resumes. But
the important part is these are people who clearly know what they're doing and having some experience in the medium.
Yeah, absolutely. I went to my friend Chris Dabari when we were getting it together, and I was like, "Do you know some guys who could really do well by this?" And we're really good friends, and we have been friends for a long time. So he definitely took care and time in finding the most skilled guys he could find to help us out with it.
Very, very cool. So tell me a little bit about what makes Tilt Shift a good Kickstarter project. Tell me why people should support you. Because I've had a chance to look at the page and read it and watch the video, and I'm really sold on it. But for someone who's just heard this interview so far, what makes them want to support Tilt Shift?
What should make people want to support Tilt Shift is the fact that we're trying to tell a true story. We're trying to give people a glimpse of what these special operations teams are doing, and it's not something that we've read. It's not something that we've researched it, but it's something that I personally lived.
Yeah.
And that I've documented and passed on to the art team so that they themselves can convey it in the most realistic way possible. And the reason why we're going through Kickstarter and why people should help support us through Kickstarter is to give us the freedom to tell the story the way it should be told in its entirety. Because there's not a huge market for war stuff right now. There's maybe, I think the activity, the work that Nathan Edmondson is putting out is maybe the only real successful stuff, and it's more kind of geared to the sort of Delta Force guys in plain clothes sort of situation.
Yeah.
But as far as strict military stuff, what's going on in the wars that the United States are embroiled in right now, there really isn't anyone doing that right now. No one really telling stories, especially not anyone with any firsthand knowledge of what's happening over there.
Definitely. I feel like it's something that we're not even really told in any medium, you know? I mean, there's the occasional film that might come out that really captures what it's really like to be over there, but the news doesn't tell us about it because it's been going for so long. There's nothing new to report. They're too busy chasing the next scandal or the next flub from some stupid politician. And I feel like we, as a culture, have romanticized past wars so much that we forget that we're fighting wars right now and that it's a different creature than it was in, say, World War II or Korea or places like that.
Oh, absolutely. And also a big thing with the war right now is just sort of the eggshells that everyone has to walk on all the time.
Like, yeah.
And it's something that we definitely try to portray, like the idea that, I mean, they use everything as a weapon. Like, because they're not in a uniform, they use everything as a weapon. Yeah. They, the way that, like, I mean, they use their religion as a weapon. They use, I mean, it was very eye-opening to me to be over there just to see the extent to which, I mean, you have guys shooting rockets at American troops, and while you're in hot pursuit, they will run into a house full of women and children.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know you're not just going to run in there. And then all of a sudden you have, like, a crazy standoff situation because you can't go in guns blazing because you can't create those casualties because it's not acceptable.
Yeah.
And it's a very complex, it's a difficult story to tell, especially for, like, a quick news snippet or something like that.
Yeah. It's just not as clean and concise as the news media wants it to be, I think.
Right.
And consequently, they just don't talk about it because it's easier to talk about scandal.
Absolutely.
Well, I love the idea of this project. I feel like this is a project that I really want to see come to fruition. I'm definitely going to back you guys because it seems like something I really want to see it happen.
I appreciate it.
And I hope you listeners that you too, after hearing this interview, will go and back Tilt Shift. It looks beautiful. The art that I've seen on the Kickstarter page is great. Obviously, after talking to Jose for this last 20 minutes, you can see he's down to earth and he obviously knows what he's talking about. So I definitely encourage you listeners to go and back this project. It seems like one that is definitely worth your time, effort, and money. So do you have any last thing you'd like to say to our listeners, Jose?
Any last thing I'd like to say? Just pretty much that sometimes I feel like I was doing a paper on Guy Debord once, and he talks about how the fall of Western society, part of it would come from the replacing of heroes with celebrities, and that the idea that it would be more important to appear to have done something than to have actually done it would kind of cloud people's minds and their opinions. And it's something we're trying to combat with this book is the idea of what people view as a hero and what people view as someone you should follow and like a work of real bravery. And so we hope that people support it. We hope that there's the market out there because honestly, these are people who dedicate their lives to the security of everyone here in America.
Definitely. If that doesn't sell you, I don't know what will. I definitely agree with you. Those, and you know, who else pulls out Guy Debord? I mean, props on that.
Thank you.
So, you know, obviously one of our best read interviews so far. Anyway, thanks again for some time this evening, Jose. It was a lot of fun to talk to you. You definitely seem inspired in this project that you're working on, and it seems like a very important project. We were really glad to get in contact with you, and like I say, we will definitely support this project, and we hope that the listeners do as well. So once again, thanks all for listening, and happy reading. Hey, Between the Bubbles is a production of Almost Midnight Media and is released under a Creative Commons license. Yep, that's it.